It is really a pleasure to have all the way from Australia, Father Frank Brennan. He is the 2014-15 Gassin Professor, which is Boston College's oldest endowed chair reserved for a distinguished Jesuit in any field of academic study who comes to Boston College to teach and do research. His academic appointment is here at the law school. Down under, he's professor of law at the Australian Catholic University and adjunct professor at the Australian National University College of Law, as well as the National Center for Indigenous Studies. He was the founding director of UNIA, the Australian Jesuit Social Service Center, and is presently the advocate in residence for Catholic Health Australia, Catholic Social Services Australia, and the St. Vincent de Paul Society. He's written a number of books. I won't list them all because we'll talk about two others that he's recently completed while here at Boston College. So this is how productive you can be here at BC. In 1995, Father Brennan was named an Officer of the Order of Australia in recognition of his services to Aboriginal Australians, particularly as an advocate in the areas of law, social justice, and reconciliation. And in 1998, the National Trust classified him as a living national treasure during his involvement in the legal debate over Indigenous land rights. And what an extraordinary accomplishment. Many other titles and awards I won't mention, but we are just so pleased to have you here at Boston College and especially at the Wazzy Center today. So thank you, Father Brennan, for being here.
Thank you. Thanks, Eric, and good afternoon, everyone. Particular greetings to those who I don't know. Many I do know. I brought my choir along to hear, hopefully. And I've been asked to address the topic, Eric, being a priest in the public square, the experience from down under. It's a great delight for me to be here to do this. At this time, Monday, I turned 40 years as a Jesuit. And I joined the Jesuits in 1975, the year that the Jesuits held what was called the 32nd General Congregation. And one of the key documents of that congregation was Decree 4, paragraph 2 of which said that what Jesuits are about is the relationship between faith and justice and also reconciliation, reconciliation with God and reconciliation of humanity. So for me, I suppose the ideas of faith, justice and reconciliation have been drivers where I've been a priest and a lawyer in the public square in Australia. And even if you know little about Australia, you know that the original sin of our nation is the treatment of the Indigenous Australians. And I've been very privileged to spend 30 years' work on that particular issue and with those peoples. And of recent times, our treatment of asylum seekers, refugees, in terms of the context of the migration debate and questions of national security. So they're the issues which have long concerned me. I've had the opportunity every 10 years of late to come to the US, which has been great, and usually be at a Jesuit university. And I might just give a very broad brush pen picture of those three experiences. 94-5, I came to Georgetown. I had a Fulbright there. And I was greatly influenced by the late Bob Drinan. And I did an international human rights course with him. And we used to have lots of conversations of the evening or whatever. I think here in the US, if I may say, at that time, there was still, if you like, the enthusiasm of the US bishops' documents on peace and the economy from 1983 and 86. Now, people like David Hollenbach, who, of course, were very involved. There was a sense that we were able to have a conversation and that that conversation could be brought to the public square and that it was of utility in terms of the shaping of a nation. And while there, I wrote a book called Legislating Liberty. And that book was about looking at the fact that your constitutional arrangements here are very different, of course, from Australia. It's not to say that one's better than another, but it is to say that where you have a Bill of Rights, where unelected judges have the final say on all sorts of questions, there's the prospect of very fine, reasoned legal argument about what otherwise might be seen simply as moral, political questions. There are, of course, advantages in having elected politicians to bring a final resolution to a conflict, such as you would not get with an unelected judiciary. And so I saw there with treatment of issues, for example, such as abortion, that it's a similar sort of social question in both countries. It's probably been more resolved to the satisfaction of the community generally in Australia because the final word is had by elected politicians. The actual practice in relation to abortion in both countries is exactly the same. Well, 10 years later, I then had a gig here at the Jesuit Institute. 2004-05. You might remember it was the year where you were having the election, the re-election of George W. Bush. The figure who comes to mind instead of Bob Drynan is Archbishop Burke, and questions about who would be denied communion during an election campaign. And for me, the documents which seem to resonate from that period, and these are always documents that were written 10 years before but have their effect about this time, not so much the documents on peace and the economy, but probably John Paul II's encyclicals Veritatis Splendor and Evangelium Vitae. And so there was a sense that, for me, that conversation was closing down, and it was much more difficult to engage in the public square as someone who was bringing something of the Catholic tradition to bear. Either there was the risk of being silenced by one's religious authorities, or what one would say would be judged completely irrelevant in the public square of a pluralist democratic society. So while there, I wrote a book called Acting on Conscience, looking at the place of law, religion and politics, and the place of conscience in the public square and in public debate. And then I did a second edition of a book called Tampering with Asylum, which was looking at Australia's increasingly recalcitrant approach to the treatment of asylum seekers. So then here this year, I think the two documents, or not so much two documents, but two things I'd refer to, strangely you might think at first, is Benedict's encyclical Deus Caritas Est. For me, it was an encyclical that gave what I would call the theological room to move, once again in the public square, something of the wiggle room. I mean, to just highlight a couple of the things that Pope Benedict said there, that the Church's role is to help form consciences, stimulate insight into the authentic requirements of justice, contribute to the purification of reason, ethical formation, but the Church cannot and must not remain on the sidelines in the fight for justice, and has a role to play in rational argument and reawakening spiritual energy and developing openness of mind. Those things I found inspiring and gave me space, I thought, once more in the public square, what I call the theological wiggle room. Well, then comes Pope Francis, who I think gives the pastoral wiggle room. And just to call to mind two things, it says he's not changing any church teaching, but for example, on those who happen to be gay or lesbian, he simply says, well, who am I to judge? And in relation to that encyclical Humanae Vitae on birth control, he says, well, he's not changing it, but that the answer, of course, is dialogue, and the outcome has to be responsible parenthood, and that there are many, many licit ways of doing this. Well, if a pope can say that, anyone can say that within the life of the church community, and it gives that sort of pastoral amplitude for engagement in the public square. So, against that background, I've been able to work here again, and I'd just like to say a couple of more things of points of comparison. The issues tend to be much the same. I mean, if you look at the neuralgic issues, which are often referred to by the Catholic Church, issues such as abortion, same-sex marriage, physician-assisted suicide, they play themselves out in our societies at about exactly the same time. And the way they play out here in the United States is that ultimately 9 judges of the US Supreme Court will give a decision. What happens in Australia is ultimately our federal parliament will make a decision. It'll be much the same decision. The mode of argument in the end will be much the same, but the various templates, of course, that are used are very different, because here you have to use the judicial method. The other thing is that there's also concern about those at the borders of life. I've been taken with a line of Kent Greenewalt's talking about the borderlines of status. It's there that I think there's real work to be done in the public square by those who are informed by the Catholic tradition. There are, of course, in our societies, I think, similar what I call public nodal points. They're autonomy, discrimination and human rights. That if you can plead autonomy, you're presumed to have the right answer. That, of course, we're all opposed to discrimination of any sort, and that we're all demonstrably in favour of human rights. But where the difficult areas can be are in terms of finding, well, what place is there for the common good, the public interest, the protection of those who are truly vulnerable in the society. I have the good fortune, my father, who was Chief Justice of Australia, but in retirement, muses on lots of these things. And he wrote to me about what I should be reflecting on here at BC on the role of the priest in public square. He said this: to create by example, by precept, and by proclamation, the social conditions that facilitate the dignified treatment of every person in order to allow each person to live in dignity. But more, by the same means, to explain in terms comprehensible to the contemporary individual the significance of God's love and the life God has intended for humankind, and to demonstrate the vastly enhanced significance of dignity to the believing individual and the moral unacceptability of undignified treatment because it interferes with the divine plan for humankind. Well, I think that's not a bad life project, and I found it quite helpful.
Thanks, Dad.
Rowan Williams is one writer I've always found helpful because you can get away from a lot of that papal stuff. And he's had this good idea about multiple affiliations, and any time we relate, whether within the church community or outside of the church community, those of us who are religious, we can identify as members of our church, but we're also citizens of a robust, pluralistic, democratic society. And anything we say in the public square has to make sense on both levels. The next issue is that for me, I think one of the things in Australia, and I think also here, which has made it much more difficult to be engaged in the public square, is just the lack of coherence and credibility of the church as a social institution, particularly in relation to the issue of child sexual abuse. And so that it's become an issue not so much of what the church says in its teachings, not even so much in what we do, but what have we got in terms of structures which reflect the commitment to dignity, transparency and justice. And so how do we do that while maintaining some sort of credibility with our own bishops, while at the same time maintaining some sort of credibility in the public square? In Australia, we had a royal commission called into abuse, which is still ongoing. It was called in mid-November 2012. I just want to quote to you a few lines of what I said in a public speech in Australia 2 weeks before the calling of the royal commission. There was no suggestion of a royal commission at that stage, but I was speaking at an event which was an annual event in Parliament House in Sydney for the awarding of justice awards to people in the legal profession who'd done great work for social justice. And so the political and legal who's who of the country was there. In part, I said this: whatever our religion or none, whatever our love or loathing of the Catholic Church, what's to be done in the name of law and justice? Clearly the church itself cannot be left alone to get its house in order. That would be a wrongful invocation of freedom of religion in a pluralist democratic society. The state may have a role to play. As our elected politicians prudentially decide how best to proceed, they need assistance from lawyers committed to justice, not lawyers acting primarily to protect the church or to condemn it. At the moment, there's little more that any Catholic priest can credibly say on this issue in the public square. I make this plea to all lawyers having a commitment to justice. While putting aside any religious prejudice, please contribute fearlessly to the debate on how religious and other organisations increasingly charged by the state with responsibility for the oversight of the care and nurture of our most vulnerable children can perform their tasks freed from the abuse of the past and with state protection of all children assured. And please advise how we can better deal with complaints which surface decades later. So, with that as the context, just as, if you like, a small case study of the role of the priest in the public square, I've just chosen this interview, which went to air on national television in Australia the night that the Royal Commission was announced.
He drove from the south coast of New South Wales to join us in our Sydney studio just a short time ago. Father Brennan, thanks so much for coming in tonight.
Good to be with you.
Now, you were opposed to a royal commission per se. What are your reservations?
I was opposed to a national royal commission because I thought there were a number of state inquiries underway that could be useful. and my concern about a national commission. I would hope for the sake of victims nationwide that it will bear fruit. My worry has been that a national royal commission, for example, the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, which was restricted to 99 deaths over just a 10-year period, that took 3.5 years. So I think a commission of the breadth that the Prime Minister has announced, if it was to be anything more than broad brush, but if it were to have the particularity that we were looking for with state inquiries, I think it will take at least 5 years.
So would it have been better to have been kept to just the Catholic Church?
I don't know whether just to the Catholic Church or whether within the jurisdictions that were conducting these things. Let's remember within the Federation that we have that most of the agencies which deal with children are under state jurisdiction. And at the moment in the three most populous states, Queensland, New South Wales and Victoria, there are inquiries presently running, and they are running as a result of royal commissions that have been previously held. So my concern is simply that at a national level, a royal commission asking the feds to come and investigate the states, particularly where it's a federal Labor government on a ropes in the lead up to a federal election with Liberal state governments, I think there are all sorts of complications there, and I would hope for the sake of the victims that things do not get too politically messy.
The Prime Minister, in making her announcement today, said the Royal Commission would look at institutional responses to abuse. From what you've seen thus far, has the Church always, in your view, put the welfare of children first?
No, it has not. And I think particularly prior to 1997, there's been abundant evidence that the Catholic Church, which is the church I know best, the interests of children were not put first. And often it was the interests of the church as an institution or of particular clerics who were spared and children were sacrificed.
And is it still policy to move a priest to another diocese if he is accused of abuse or convicted and then released?
As I understand, since 1997, with the protocols that have been put in place, definitely not. If there have been breaches of that, then it's not only a breach of the law, it's a breach of the church's own protocols.
So is there a structure in place to determine that that definitely won't happen?
There is. After the Wood Royal Commission in New South Wales, we had a protocol set up nationally for the Catholic Church, as for other equivalent churches. It's been accepted since 1997 that every church has to have a protocol in place, as should any organisation that's dealing with children. Definitely there have been problems. The Catholic protocol, I know, has been revised twice with independent legal advice, but there are still criticisms of it from victims, their families and their loved ones. There's still work to be done. The question is how that's best to be improved.
Is it time to rethink the vow of celibacy in the Catholic Church?
Well, that's another debate, but I definitely think that there would be some individuals in the Catholic Church with a vow of celibacy as Catholic priests who, to put it very bluntly, if they were married, they probably would be abusing their own children. But definitely, I think there is a case for reviewing that. But at the moment in Rome, there's no appetite for it at all, as we know.
Is there an appetite here in Australia, do you think?
Of course there is, if you speak to diocesan priests generally. But at the moment, anyone who's made a bishop will be of the view that basically it shouldn't be changed. And so what we're dealing with is a social institution which is in something of a time warp on those sorts of questions.
Why do you think the Catholic Church all over the world is finding it so hard to recruit priests?
It's not all over the world, but definitely in Western countries where there's a strong notion of individual freedom and of liberty, then definitely the question has been, why would you live a life of this sort? And I think in a country like Australia at the moment, with abuse and that sort of thing, the question for a young person would be, why would you bother?
You've said before that there is a disproportionately high number of child abusers among the Catholic clergy. Why do you think that is?
That I don't know. I was referring to the evidence that was given before the Victorian inquiry by Professor Patrick Parkinson. Now, the thing about Parkinson is he is an independent lawyer who's done a lot of work both for the Catholic Church and for the Anglican Church, and he drew a comparison of the figures between the Catholics and the Anglicans. Now, that's an area where I think a lot more work is needed to be able to explain that. And at the moment, even Catholics, those of us of goodwill, we don't have an explanation for that, and I think that's where work is needed, and that's why in the past, I've said, the Victorian Inquiry, under-resourced as it is, has available to it the retired Justice Frank Vincent, who I think is one of the most outstanding retired criminal law judges in the country. And so I think to be able to draw on the resources of people like him as they forensically investigate those questions is critical. My worry now with a national Royal Commission, which isn't just looking at the Catholic Church, but looking at agencies right across the board, I think it's going to be another 5 years before we get those sorts of forensic answers, which I was hoping we might get within some months.
Mm. Now, former priest Kevin Lee joined us here on the program on Friday, and he said, and I quote to you, that in the course of his life as a priest, I became aware, he says, that some of the other priests were actually pedophiles and were not necessarily becoming priests because they wanted to help people, but because they were pedophiles who wanted the opportunity. What's your response to that?
Well, my own personal experience is quite different, and I say thank God for that. But if there is evidence of that sort of thing, then I think it's highly regrettable. Definitely the figures we've heard in Victoria indicating that there seems to be a high percentage compared with the Anglicans of those coming through the seminary there who have been offenders, then I think it's very troubling for all of us. I mean, let's keep the focus on the victims and their families, but this is also highly troubling and very deeply shaming for those of us who pride ourselves on being loyal members of the Catholic Church.
Is there something wrong with the structure of the Catholic Church insofar as there is no sort of the umbrella hierarchical structure here in Australia? It is so state and diocese based, so it's very hard for you to know perhaps if a priest's been moved from interstate or indeed from overseas, what his particular past has been.
I think there are now protocols in place that deal with that. I may say, I think the real problem with the Catholic Church is the sort of unaccountable clericalism. I was preaching in my parish in Canberra on Sunday, and I told them the story. I'd been in Rome 2 years ago. I attended a meeting. I went across with two of my brother Jesuits from the United States. I attended a splendid concert that the Vatican put on. And there was Pope Benedict, and as the symphony played, an American priest turned to me and said, "That man beside the Pope, that's Cardinal Law." He said, "If he was back home, he'd be in jail." I was very ashamed at that moment, and I thought there is a structural problem, but it's not in terms, as you've discussed, I think it's more the sort of unaccountable clericalism of a male celibate hierarchy, and I think there are fundamental challenges for the Church in the 21st century.
He'd be in jail for what?
Well, for things to do with failure to deal adequately with priests who've been proven to be engaged in child abuse.
So the accountability or the lack of accountability goes that high up within the Church?
Sadly, it does.
So do you have faith in the ability of your Church to deal with these matters in such a way that protects children?
I think the Church is a very broken institution, but one of the great things in living in a country like Australia is that we robustly pride ourselves on the rule of law, and we're a pluralist democratic society where the Church is not exempt from things on the basis of some spurious pleading of freedom of religion. And so what's essential, and I think this is accepted in good faith, I mean, the statement by our Australian Catholic bishops today indicates they're accepting of a Royal Commission. They'll do anything they can to cooperate. Now, the cynics about the Church will say, well, of course they'd say that now, wouldn't they? But I think part of the reality of living in a pluralist democratic society is the people you meet in church every Sunday, they're members of the Church, but they're also citizens of a robust pluralist democracy which prides itself on the protection of the vulnerable, including the most vulnerable children. But what's going to be shown from this Royal Commission isn't only churches, it's the nation as a whole, and there are going to be very political questions as to what's ruled in and what's ruled out with a national commission of this inquiry.
We look forward to speaking to you again as the inquiry takes shape. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, I thought it was just a good example of the complexity of engaging in the public square nowadays with the face of the Church. And
I will be recommending to the Governor-General that a Royal Commission be appointed to inquire into institutional responses to instances of allegations of child.
At the time, people said I was being censorious, saying the Commission would last for 5 years. Well, its terms of reference have now been extended to 5 years, and it was very clear to anyone at that time that that's what would happen. But as I say, just to highlight the complexity, and to conclude, I just want to go on and say a word about the two books I've been working on here against this sort of backdrop. One is a collection of some of my public talks and writings, which I've revised and updated in light of the discussions I've been having here. I've given it the title Amplifying That Still Small Voice, which is a wonderful quote from Seamus Heaney when he wrote for Amnesty on the 60th anniversary of the UN Declaration of Human Rights in 2008. He wrote this: "Since it was framed, the Declaration has succeeded in creating an international moral consensus. It's always there as a means of highlighting abuse, if not always as a remedy. It exists instead in the moral imagination, as an equivalent of the gold standard in the monetary system. The articulation of its tenets has made them into world currency of a negotiable sort. Even if its articles are ignored or flouted, in many cases by governments who have signed up to them, it provides a worldwide amplification system for that still small voice." And I make the point that that still small voice is the voice of conscience, but it's also the voice of those who are marginalised and alienated within our society. I'm particularly happy with the cover there. I might just tell the story of the front cover, the photo there. After I'd written that book, Legislating Liberty, 20 years ago, I was known as something of a fence sitter in Australia about the idea of whether or not we needed better legislative protection of human rights in Australia. And so the federal government appointed me to conduct a national human rights consultation in 2009. And we had a lot of community consultations all around Australia. And I turn up, I had 13 officers from the Attorney General's Department as my secretariat. And I remember joking with them at one stage that all members of the secretariat were very able young women lawyers. And I said to them one day, I said, do any blokes do human rights? And they said, no, they do trade and corporations. Anyway, we turned up in this remote country town of Kalgoorlie. Now, we arrived there and there was an inquest being held in a courthouse about the death of an Aboriginal man who'd been apprehended and he'd been put in the back of a police paddy wagon where he'd been transported for many hours where the temperature was in the 50s centigrade, so, I don't know, 120 Fahrenheit or whatever, and he tragically died. And so there was this inquest that was being held, and I said to the officers from the Attorney General's Department, we'll just go down to the courthouse, see what's going on, because that'll be what's most on people's mind when we have the consultation this afternoon out at the racetrack. Anyway, we got down there and I said to them, now, make sure you keep out of the public eye because all the nation's TV cameras were there. And so we start walking into the courtroom. Well, this Aboriginal guy here, a man by the name of Ben Taylor, who I'd known for over 20 years, and he came from Perth, which was some hundreds of miles away. But Ben saw me and he called out, hey, Father Frank, over here, you've got to support us mob. And I thought, oh my God, here I am conducting a non-partisan consultation for the federal government on human rights, but the Aboriginal guy says, you've got to come over here and stand with us mob. So that's why I came and I stood looking as passive as possible there in solidarity. Next day I got on the plane flying back to Perth and I sat down and there was a woman next to me who'd opened the West Australian newspaper. And on page 3 was the equivalent of this photo. I thought, oh my God, I'm going to have to resign my commission. But fortunately, I didn't have to do that. But when I boldly suggested that this photo should appear in the report of the commission, the Attorney General's Department denied permission. So I'm very happy to be able to put it on the front page of this book. This book, what I'm wanting to do, I'll just give you a quick idea in terms of the table of contents. Amplifying That Still Small Voice in the Church. Celebrating a New Pope. Scrutinising a Non-Transparent Hierarchy. Handing on the Faith. Making Room for Aborigines in the Church. Dealing with Child Sexual Abuse and Bringing the Church into the World. And then Amplifying That Still Small Voice in the World. Pursuing Human Rights. Insisting on the Separation of Powers. Respecting religious freedom and freedom of conscience, recognising Aboriginal rights, dealing with asylum claims, respecting autonomy and protecting the vulnerability of the dying, espousing marriage and respecting the dignity of same-sex couples. And then finally, the other book I've been working on, No Small Change, I just want to highlight briefly, and I'll conclude with this. One of the complexities for me, being a non-Indigenous Australian, how do you play a constructive role in terms of enhancing the protection of Indigenous rights when you're dealing with the very difficult question of constitutional reform? Now, the first question, of course, is, well, what do Indigenous Australians themselves want? Now, we now have a well-educated Indigenous middle class. But as I say, like most middle class people, you don't expect them all to agree with each other. And so you've got educated Aboriginal lawyers, you've got educated Aboriginal leaders in public service and in other fields, but there's not necessarily unanimity as to what they would be seeking. And even if there be unanimity, what is possible within the constitutional architecture when, for example, you do not have a Bill of Rights in your constitution? Some of the Indigenous leaders at the moment have been saying, we would like a clause in the constitution that says you will not discriminate against us on the basis of race. But a one-line entry like that in a constitution which doesn't contain a Bill of Rights, how could that possibly be done? These are very difficult legal constitutional questions where you've got to respect constitutional architecture as well as what might be the wishes of the Indigenous people. Furthermore, the Australian Constitution is an extraordinarily democratic document. It can only be amended by a vote of the majority of people in the majority of states as well as by the overall majority of people. And there are only six states, so you've got to get over 50% of the population in four of the six states, as well as nationally, supporting any referendum proposal. Now, as you can imagine, the pleading for special rights for Indigenous peoples is not something which resonates readily with a population like modern-day Australia. So these are extraordinarily complex questions that require respectful relationships, where there can be a work towards that which is a more just outcome. So there's some of the complexities of being a priest in the public square.
It all seems pretty straightforward. Yeah.